from Palestine. This is a special edition of the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. In the 7 months since Hamas's October assault on southern Israeli communities, the Israeli military has demolished over 300,000 Gazan homes, almost three-quarters of the besieged ghetto's housing stock. Armed with U.S. bombs and missiles, Israel destroys Palestinian homes in an instant. Palestinian suffering and trauma will endure for generations. What's its aim? Ethnic cleansing, genocide, and the consolidation of its century-old settler colonial regime. So says Israeli author and activist Jeff Halper. The GPM sat down with Jeff Halper for a wide-ranging discussion about the deep roots of Israel's current war on the people of Gaza and about Washington's unstinting support for Israeli ultraviolence and oppression. Jeff Halper is a founding member of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. I spoke with Jeff Halper in his home in West Jerusalem. Hello, Jeff Halper.
Hello, David Kattenberg.
For people who've never heard of Jeff Halper, much less met him.
There aren't any.
How would you describe yourself? Who is Jeff Halper? You've been an activist for decades and decades and decades. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, who are you?
Well, I guess the best definition would be a child of the 60s. You know, I was at the epitome of the 60s, the class of 68 at the university. This is the height of the 60s.
And you were born in Hibbing, Minnesota.
Born in Hibbing, Minnesota.
Dylan's hometown.
So I was born, I knew Bob as a kid. You know, I was a draft resistor to the Vietnam War. I was in Mississippi during the civil rights movement. I was at Woodstock. I was at the Chicago Convention in 1968 with Mayor Daley and the whole police riot. So I'm really kind of I checked all the boxes of what it meant to be a 60s radical at that time.
And were you raised, you're Jewish, of course, were you raised as a Zionist? Were you raised in...
No, up in Hibbing, no one ever heard of Zionism. I mean, there was nothing like that. It was just a small town, Jewish family. My father was the Jewish doctor in town. Hibbing itself was kind of a radical place. You know, it was the center of the iron ore mining industry. And I worked in the mines for
the
a
iron
while.
Range.
The Iron Range. And it was populated by immigrants from Sweden, Finland especially, Croatia, Italy. And then there were Native Americans there as well. So that there are no white, you know, the WASPs that would be the ones that you had to kowtow to that you had to melt into. So it was a kind of a society in which the workers from all these different countries kind of acculturated each other. So it was in a sense a very left-wing, left political, you know, the cooperative movement in the United States started in northern Minnesota. So it was a very strong socialist, cooperative, left-wing worker culture that I came out of. I'm sure it affected Bob Zimmerman. But it certainly affected me as well. And then, you know, we came into the 60s. In those days, if you were like a young Republican, somehow you were a pariah or you were just weird or whatever. So in other words, I grew up in an area of the country that was very left-wing and working class. And then moved into the country in general that became, you know, the 60s with all the activism and everything else. So that stayed with me. So when I came to Israel, I wasn't a Zionist, but the 60s ended on January 1st, 1970. And we begin to get into the whole neoliberal era. You know, Nixon's elected, and so we have to remember that at the height of the 60s, Nixon's elected in 68. And then we begin to get into the Reagan era and so on. So I became more and more alienated from life in the States. It just seemed to be dumb and pointless and meaningless. And, you know, and the whole consumer culture was beginning to reassert itself after we had tried to kind of fend off capitalism in the 60s. And so I was looking for somewhere to go. But somewhere where I could, and I'm an anthropologist by profession, so somewhere I could be an anthropologist, but I could also be politically active. And Israel was a place, because I was Jewish, that I could be politically active. And there was another point to it. In the 60s, it was also, there was a stream of identity politics. Don't forget you had Alex Haley's book, Roots, and so the African Americans really became the first ethnic group in the United States to validate where they came from, rather than melting, because obviously after 400 years they weren't melting very well in the melting pot. Rather than that, they began to reassert, and Roots was the expression of that, their African background. And then you began to have Cesar Chavez, what was called the Chicano community at that time, the Latinos. And then you had, you know, all the other ethnic groups began to say, yeah, you know, we also have our histories and our heritage that we don't want to lose. So in all of that, you know, I'm Jewish, not religious in any way. And I had no real Jewish background, but I wanted to kind of explore that identity.
Did you see Israel back then as this doughty little country that had been assaulted in its cradle by the Arab nations and was this wonderfully brave country and nation states surrounded by terrorists trying to kill Jews? And
No. By that time, the occupation had happened.
What year did you come to Israel?
Well, so I came in 73 as a graduate student. I did my PhD field work here. But you see, on the contrary, I came as a leftist. I didn't come as a Zionist. I came as a leftist because I wanted to be involved in the political struggle, but I didn't find the political struggle in the U.S. to be relevant to me. I just didn't feel any tie, you know, to the labor movement, or I certainly wouldn't be part of the movement for African-American rights. I'm not a woman. In fact, I organized with Father Groppi, who was a very famous figure in the 60s, a Catholic priest in Milwaukee, where I was in school, one of the last big gatherings of the left in the United States. It was kind of the last gasp of the 60s. I was one of the organizers with him. And we organized this whole conference. People came from all over the United States from the left. And the whole program, you know, was based on, you know, labor issues, women's issues, racial issues. There was all kinds of class things because it was a very Marxist thing. And then there was liberation theology because it was at a church. And all the issues, capitalism. And, you know, and then the first day of the conference, I'm trying to say to myself, well, where do I fit into this? And I didn't really fit into all these American-defined issues. I was somehow outside of that. None of them really spoke. And it really came to, I really came to realize that I really don't have a future in the United States in any meaningful political sense. And I was, again, you know, we were very political in the 60s. It was in our blood, sort of. So I came to Israel as another front in the revolution, let's say. Here, I was very aware of the occupation. It was new. I mean, the Six-Day War had only happened 6 years before I came, 1967. I came in 73. And I came just in time for the Yom Kippur War. But the first thing I did when I got here was I joined the Israeli peace movement. So this isn't a story of somebody who came as a Zionist and saw Israel as this Paul Newman Exodus kind of, you know, society, and then gets disillusioned and finds his way to the left. I came as a leftist. I came knowing there's an occupation, knowing about the Palestinian issue and so on. So it was a mixture of kind of wanting to come to Israel, and not in any Jewish way, but, you know, what I liked about Israel was the national sense of it. You know, it was a, you know, like I told you earlier in our own conversations, I would define myself more as a cultural Zionist. In other words, I do think the Jewish people have a tie to this country. But But there can't be an Israel, political sense, because that's a form of settler colonialism. It's a form of oppression. You're displacing the Palestinian people. So my idea was to, on the one hand, kind of reconnect with a place that's meaningful for Jews, with a Jewish population, but on the other hand, work very much for an end to, we didn't use those terms in those days, the colonial thing, but the end of the occupation, to a just peace with Palestinians, living together. So I sort of combined my own personal identity issues with my left beliefs, working for social justice.
And back then, when you got here, maybe within 3 or 4 or 5 years, did you slowly start to see Israel as a settler colonial state, maybe even as an apartheid state?
That's been only in the last 10, 15 years. That whole vocabulary of settler colonialism only really arises recently, in the last decade or so. No, on the contrary, I think it was more the idea that the occupation happened, but it was temporary, and our job was to end the occupation. It was certainly a two-state idea in those days. We didn't have much contact with Palestinians. I mean, they also, this is just at a time when the PLO is beginning to emerge gradually. The PLO had not yet adopted. That was way later in 1988 when they adopted the two-state solution. That was a disaster for them. So they were still in an anti-colonial mindset. That was their struggle, was anti-colonial. So they were trying to liberate Palestine from the Zionists.
And militant and armed struggle.
And armed struggle.
Quote-unquote terrorism, assaults on
airliners. Well, you had the airliners and all that. Yeah, armed struggle against Israel. But the idea was that there would still be an Israel somehow. I mean, I was an Israeli. So the idea was to end the occupation. Ending the occupation means, it wasn't clear what our agenda was, actually. We wanted to, because the whole thing was new. And we didn't, there weren't settlements yet. There are a couple little settlements beginning, but you didn't have Begin. You didn't have Sharon. I mean, the right way, this was still a labor, socialist country, kind of. And what happened in 48, the Nakba, we didn't use the word Nakba, that wasn't a term yet. So what happened in 48 was already kind of in the background. It wasn't part of the political discussion. And don't forget that, the Palestinians really, I think after the Great Revolt of 1936 to 1939, when they rose up in revolt against the British and the Zionists and were put down in a brutal way. So they were so exhausted, and in a way, their infrastructure was so destroyed and their economy, that they weren't able to resist effectively in 1948 being put down. Their repression was so severe in the 30s that they hadn't recovered by 1948. So 1948, the Nakba happens, and the Palestinians are just knocked out. Half the Palestinians are now refugees. 85% of the Palestinians that lived in what became Israel were driven out as refugees. Their villages and towns were destroyed. Their lands were taken. I mean, they were really reeling. They were against the ropes. So by the early 1970s, they were just beginning with the PLO, and don't forget the PLO only came under Palestinian directorship rather than Egyptian sponsorship only after the 67 war. So in 1973, the PLO was just in the stages of kind of organizing itself and the struggle and articulating the struggle and Palestinians coming in, so that everything that happened before in 48, the Nakba, wasn't a part of the conversation. So in other words, we were in a conflict. We had an occupation. We wanted to make peace with Palestinians, but it wasn't clear. Certainly we didn't adopt as Israelis the idea of liberating Palestine and getting rid of Israel and becomes a Palestine. That we didn't buy into. We thought of an Israel that would somehow make peace with the Palestinians. But what that meant was very vague.
Now, let's try to fast forward, because we could talk for hours about all this history.
Now that's 50 years ago.
And that was 50 years ago. How did ICAT come about? When did you form the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions? And let's move through this kind of relatively quickly.
Well, I mean, I was very involved in the peace movement then for many years. And in 1996, during the Oslo process, Netanyahu was elected for the first time. And Netanyahu was elected on an explicitly anti-Oslo peace process program. When he was elected, the occupation was reasserting itself in a very brutal way. So in 1997, a number of Israeli peace groups came together, and I was part of that. And we decided we have to re-engage in fighting the occupation. We had, as a peace movement, we had given Oslo a chance. So from 93, the end of 93, when Oslo begins, to the election of Netanyahu in 96, middle of 96, we had kind of stopped our activities. There wasn't protests. There was, you know, we were giving the negotiations a chance, even if we were doubtful about them. But it was clear by 96, 97 that we had to reengage. Now, how do we reengage? Well, we went out and talked to some Palestinian partners that we had, and they're the ones who suggested to us that we focus on house demolitions, because that was one of the most painful parts of the occupation. We didn't know anything about it, and we hadn't really worked with Palestinians in a systematic way. So we set up ICAD, which was the Israeli Committee. Why committee? Because it was an aggregate of all these different peace organizations that came together against house demolitions. And the idea is we would focus on that, but we wouldn't start a new group because other groups still existed. So one group would focus on settlements. One group would focus on the repressive elements of the occupation. Another group, in other words, is sort of division. We focused on house demolitions. And so we began in 1997. I became the head of the group at that time, of that particular group. But in fact, what happened was that we were very effective, if I can say so. We got funding from the EU and from the UN and from churches and from all kinds of places. We had an office, we had a staff. So we became one of the leading organizations. We were more than just an activist group. In other words, we really got to know the lay of the land. Before us, we pioneered working with Palestinians. Before our activities, Israeli peace groups would have a demonstration on their own. They would initiate it, and they might go to the West Bank, and they might have a demonstration against a settlement, but they initiated it. It was Israeli speakers, and it had nothing to do with Palestinians. But you couldn't work on the house demolition issue without being in touch with families, finding out what's happening, working with local communities, working with Palestinian partners. So, and even the demolition in Annata. We didn't even know where Annata was. Annata is a Palestinian town, kind of. Half of it's in Jerusalem. We didn't know anything about the lay of the land. I have to say, for all these years, the Israeli peace movement really didn't know much about Palestine or Palestinians, or, for example, who's issuing demolition orders. We didn't know. We didn't really know that much about the civil administration, the whole mechanism of it, what the intent was, who's getting demolished. We didn't know. I mean, I have to say, it's embarrassing to say, but after all these years, we had stayed at the level of being against occupation, but we never got, really involved. What we discovered was two things, just really quickly. First of all, that house demolitions is the essence of the colonization. We discovered as we backed into it that it really is the essence of the so-called conflict, because it has to do with displacement, and house demolitions is key to that.
And dispossession.
But at the same time, we had to deliver. In other words, you can't make a contact with a family whose home has been demolished and come and say, well, we're in solidarity with you, we're really sorry, and do hold up a sign and then go home. Families say, hey, wait a minute, what are you going to rebuild for us? Are you going to support us financially? Are you going to bring this forward politically? And that forced us really to get serious about our political work in a way that the left hadn't been that serious before. It had been more of a protest movement.
How many homes have been demolished over the course of 56 years of Israel's occupation.
In the Nakba, you know, in 1948, 750,000 Palestinians were thrown out of the country, were displaced. But their villages and towns and urban areas were intact. They weren't destroyed during the war. Israel took all their lands and gave them to the kibbutzim and the moshavim. And then from 48 on into the 60s, it systematically demolished more than 500 entire Palestinian villages and towns and urban areas inside Israel. So that destruction to prevent the refugees from coming back didn't happen in the heat of battle. So that destruction was something like, we've counted, something like 52,000 Palestinian homes were destroyed in the Nakba and in the wake of the Nakba. Okay? 52,000. Fast forward to 1967. From 1967 until today, we leave Gaza, this last operation in Gaza since October, out for a minute. From 1967 until today, another 60,000 homes have been demolished in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, but also inside Israel. What's important to understand is that the Nakba never ended, and Israel is continuing to settle inside Israel, to confiscate Palestinian land inside Israel, and to demolish. There are some years in which there's more demolitions inside Israel of Israeli citizens who are Palestinians than there are in the occupied territory. So 52,000 in the Nakba, 60,000 in the occupied territories since 67, and now in the last 6 months, since October 2023, you know, the Hamas attack, another 300,000 homes have been demolished in Gaza just in the last 6 months, 70% of the housing. So you can see from all of that, not only the tremendous and tragic impact this has, I mean, you can't imagine the depth of the trauma, losing your home, people getting, it's a very violent process. So people get killed in the process, they get hurt, and it's traumatizing. I mean, this, it's not like a demolition happens, it's too bad, and you get on with your life the next day. Your kids are traumatized, it stays with you forever, and there are many families in which their homes are demolished, two, three. We've had one family work with six times their home has been demolished. In Gaza, let's not forget, 80% of the people in Gaza are refugees themselves. So they've been demolished and driven out in the Nakba and driven into Gaza, and now... And this isn't the first time their homes have been demolished. There's been tremendous attacks, you know, over the last 20 years of Israel and Gaza. So in other words, I'm just saying that the scale and the violence, but this almost obsession of Israel with demolishing Palestinian homes has to do with ethnic cleansing and with the basic fact of settler colonialism, which is Israel trying to replace Palestine, to transform an Arab country into a Jewish country, and to replace the indigenous Palestinian population with a Jewish one.
Is what's going on
and you can't
Gaza,
do that without house demolitions.
Is what's going on in Gaza right now genocidal? Is Israel committing genocide in Gaza?
No, it's for sure it's committing genocide, which means the destruction of a whole or a part of a people. It's clear, you know, there's been at least 14,000 children killed, you know, in the last 6 months. And it's not only physical killing, you know, genocide has to do with making it impossible for the culture to function, destroying the culture itself, and making it impossible for the people to reproduce themselves in the next generation. They become refugees and they simply lose their entire collective existence. That's a part of genocide. But what's important, and we put out a statement, ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, just a few weeks after it started, saying not only is this genocide in Gaza, but it's just the latest flare-up of genocide. Genocide is built into settler colonialism. Like I said, you can't displace a people, take their land, and replace them with your own people as settlers, and then completely redo the country without destroying that culture. and violently throwing out those people and killing them because they have to resist. They can't not resist, and so they get killed in the resistance. So that the genocide is built into the settler colonial project. So basically what we're saying is genocide began in 1948, 47 even. It didn't start on October 7th in Gaza. And so even if you have doubts, you know, the court has said it hasn't ruled yet. The ICJ has ruled this is plausible genocide. Even if you can say, well, Gaza itself now doesn't rise to the level of genocide, if you put it within the context of the last 56, 57 years of systematic genocidal settler colonialism against Palestinians, you know, in that broader context, it's definitely genocide and ongoing genocide.
And yet U.S. Defense Minister Austin and National Security Advisor Kirby, what's his first name, John Kirby?
Yeah, I think so.
They say, no, absolutely not. There's no evidence. We've got no evidence that Israel is committing genocide. Of course, if they said, yeah, we think it's pretty plausible, they'd be complicit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we'd barely imagine them acknowledging the plausibility of the genocide charge. But they say, no, it's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's not just genocide, apartheid. You know, when all these human rights organizations, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, which is the main Israeli human rights organization, plus the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Territories, all came out saying this is what Israel has built here is apartheid. We already have an apartheid regime in Palestine. 2 minutes after the Amnesty report was released, he didn't have a chance to read it. The American ambassador here said, that's not the language we use. We don't use language like apartheid or genocide, you know, certainly. In other words, it's not in their vocabulary.
They don't use the language of international law.
They don't use the language of international law. This whole idea of a rules-based international order is ridiculous. It plays no role whatsoever in their considerations. And so for them, you know, it has to do with interests. It's all transactional. And Israel, you know, has much more to deliver to the United States than the Palestinians could ever deliver. And so we support them, and we can't use those kinds of terms.
So today is the 19th of April, and we've just watched Antony Blinken on television commenting on... you know, Israel's response to supposedly limited response to Iran's response to Israel's bombing of their consular offices in Damascus. And Blinken is saying
the only thing
that's coming between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas.
That's right.
Hamas is entirely to blame.
That's right. So that's, you know, I mean, that's...
And you were commenting.
You know, I commented, first of all, it's sad, it's depressing, it's revealing. If that is genuinely the analysis of the United States from Blinken and all these, but they have an entire State Department, they have departments of analysis and research, and they have intelligence services, and they have think tanks. I mean, there's 100 think tanks that feed into American policy, and the universities that feed in. If that's their analysis, that Hamas is the only barrier to a ceasefire, it shows you how poor the world is run in terms of understanding what's going on. I mean it's childish. Mike Grosser would say that.
They have all the intelligence. They know
the intelligence. But they also have the academic analysis. They have the professional. You've got people who spend their career lives researching the Middle East experts, Palestine experts, Israeli, and that's what you come up with. I mean, a child would know that's not the case. But again, it gets back to this deeper issue, and that is that it's all cynical. The words don't mean anything. Really, you know, what the United States wants to do is to preserve its and the G7's hegemony in the Middle East. And it's being challenged by China. and challenged by Russia with the Belt and Road system. And, you know, Saudi Arabia has just been brought into the BRICS alliance of the global south. And, you know, and there's anger over what Israel's doing. So a lot of countries are beginning to get critical of Israel. And it's making it hard for the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, you know, to normalize with Israel. But normalization is the name of the game, because unless the United States can marginalize and quietize this pesky Palestinian issue, doesn't want to deal with the Palestinian issue per se, because it would cost too much political capital. It's a lose-lose. If you really forced Israel into a two-state solution and removed 750,000 settlers, the whole Jewish community in the United States and the evangelicals would all rise up in rebellion in the U.S., even if the United States pressured Israel in terms of Gaza. So in other words, Biden wants to get reelected. Members of Congress want to get reelected. That's the name of the game. And all this other stuff feeds into it. So all this bullshit about, some kind of an analysis, you can't have a real, because a real analysis and the real use of terms of international law like genocide and apartheid absolutely contradict what your real purpose is and your real interest, which is asserting your hegemony over the whole area of normalizing. So you can't really deal with the issues because you don't want to expend the political capital domestically. And at the same time, you just want to quietize the Palestinian issue to a point where you can get on with the bigger issue at stake geopolitically, which is normalization. So in other words, they're talking past each other. They're sort of talking about the Palestinian issue, but really the Palestinian issue means nothing. It's just a nuisance that you've got to somehow deal with, but not resolve, because resolving it would really cost you too much political capital.
What's your assessment of what Hamas did on October 7th? Was there any degree of justification for what they did? Was this just a brutal, criminal, ISIS-like terrorist assault, or was it a resistance, an act of resistance?
No, I think it was an act of resistance. What settler colonialism always does everywhere is it criminalizes resistance. So, terrorism, the terrorists are always the non-state actors. They're never the states, even though you can see here, Israel's killed, if you include people lying under the rubble, Israel's killed more than 40,000 Palestinians. That's not terror. In other words, states aren't, there's no such thing as state terror, because states somehow have, they claim the legitimacy to use armed force. So that's legitimate, whereas resistance to colonization is not legitimate, because you're going against the state. These are non-state actors, so non-state actors don't have rights to resist. International law accepts the right of armed struggle within international law, which means you can't attack civilians. That's hard to implement, because states attack civilians all the time. So can you really ask a non-state actor who is really struggling to just exist and to continue existing in the face of oppression by a much stronger state with a state army, to that the non-state actor, the weak actor, has to be in compliance with international law and the state that's oppressing it doesn't? So it's something built in. So I'm critical of Hamas. I mean, first of all, I don't accept their program whatsoever, but I understand that they're a resistance movement. The fact that innocent civilians were killed, was a terrible thing. And there was a lot of violence, and there was sexual violence. You can never justify that. You can explain it, but you can't. I condemn, the violence isn't the right word either, because it's too broad a word, but the killing of innocent people. Okay. Having said that, terrorism has always been a part of warfare. And states have used terrorism much more than non-state actors, actually. There's a guy named Rummel, R-U-M-M-E-L, who has a website. He died a few years ago, but he has a book called Death by Government. And he says over the course of the 20th century, the whole 20th century, about 170,000 innocent people have been killed by what we call terrorists, by non-state actors, okay? Which is a lot of people, 170,000 innocent people over the whole 20th century. But he says over the course of the whole 20th century, 212 million innocent civilians have been killed by states. And in his book, But Death by Government, he enumerates, he describes exactly what he means. So states are much more culpable in terrorism than non-state actors are. They use terrorism. Certainly Israel used terrorism. Begin, Shamir were proud of the fact that their terrorist acts like blowing up the King David Hotel or blowing up markets or buses succeeded in driving the British out and intimidating the Arabs. I mean, Israel used it very, the Israeli or the Jewish militias used it all the time. Terrorism, it works. The United States and Israel and the Arab countries, Western Arab countries, were on the cusp of normalization. 2 weeks before October 7th, Netanyahu was in the UN holding up a map of the greater Israel, including the occupied territories. All this is the map of Israel, and saying we are within a week or so of signing a normalization agreement with Saudi Arabia, and this will be the new Middle East. And the price of that, of course, is, I mean, the Palestinians would have been erased as a political force. They would have been erased as an issue. And once you have normalization in Israel and the Arab world, Palestinians disappear. And that, I think, explains a lot about the timing of October 7th. This was an attack. I don't think it went the way Hamas thought. I think they were surprised that they got through. They were surprised there was no army. There were a lot of non-Hamas people that came in with them and did a lot of the killing. I mean, it was a very chaotic and messy thing. Nevertheless, that attack stopped the normalization process. It didn't happen, and I don't know if it will happen, because even though Saudi Arabia still wants to normalize with Israel, even Saudi Arabia has a street. It has public opinion. And the whole Arab world has been inflamed against Israel. And not only that, the whole world, millions of people are coming out in Europe and Asia and Latin, all over the world in support of Palestinians. So say what you will, that attack on October 7th politically stopped this normalization process. It stopped Israel from implementing completely with American support its apartheid system of nailing it down. And it's reopened. I mean, now I don't see how the international community is going to move ahead in the Middle East in any way without the Palestinians. All this stuff was done without the Palestinians. They were never really an actor. Now they're an actor. And that's because of October 7th.
So is this a turning point in Israeli and Palestinian history? And if it is, how is Israeli society responding to what happened on October 7th? And how do you see Israeli society evolving and moving forward? I mean, there are Israeli flags everywhere.
That's right.
I mean, there are often, whenever I come here, there are Israeli flags flying everywhere. But there are now. And there are all these protests. Before October 7th, there were all these massive protests against
the government.
Trying to change the judiciary.
Yeah, that's right.
Since
that's
then, they've pivoted, and now they're demanding that the hostages, Netanyahu, do what's required to release the
hostages. No, but you still have now. Those demonstrations are still anti-government. They still want Netanyahu to resign.
Do you see Israeli society evolving in a positive or constructive way, or an inwardly observant area, becoming more self-conscious in a constructive way?
No, self-conscious is not a strong Israeli trait, being reflective. And you can't, in a way, because if you're involved in a settler colonial, we use the word settler colonialism. Sometimes we don't use it in a way that we understand it. We use it as kind of a accusation. But settler colonialism means something. And it means that you're in a constant war with the colonized. The Palestinians can never, ever accept the loss of their country, the loss of their land, the loss of their livelihoods, the loss of their freedom, the loss of their identities, and simply normalize that. It can. They always have to resist. All it's built in. And for Israelis, then, not only do you have the insecurity, but Israelis can't admit what they did. They can't. So everything starts on October 7th, when Guterres, Secretary General of the UN, said this attack on October 7th happened in a context of 16 years of siege over Gaza and occupation, everything. He was really attacked by Israel because that's a can of worms. If Israelis do go back and do an account or reflect on what's happened, they have destroyed the Palestinian people. They have engaged in genocide. They have stolen the Palestinians' land. They continue to oppress them. So we can't open all that stuff up because it means the end of the whole Zionist enterprise. It means we have to admit that we were the oppressors. We have to stop the oppression, but the whole system is based on oppression. You know, you can't possibly keep Israel going without continued settlement, not only in the West Bank, but settlement inside Israel too, like I said, that's still going on, and demolishing homes. It's an ongoing process all the time. It never ends. Settler colonialism wants to normalize. That's the end for settler colonialism. But the Palestinians are strong enough, actually, unlike, let's say, the Native Americans in the U.S. or the First Nations in Canada, that were smaller populations and marginalized, so that the settler colonial project, like in Canada, could succeed and be normal. There's a normal Canada that's, in a way, accepted by the First Nations because they're simply too marginal and too powerless to try to assert some national. So they want control of their lands a little bit. They want control of their cultures. They want, recognition as First Nations, but they don't seek the overthrow of the Canadian government and a new, it's not a national movement like that. The Palestinians are. They're half the population. They're the majority if you bring refugees back. They have national aspirations. They want to end Israel. They want a Palestinian state so that.
And now you just said they're half the population. Now some people may be choking and saying, wait a minute, the Arab Palestinians are only 20% of the population.
No, I mean of the whole of all the whole country that is. There's one state today. That's what people have to understand. There is no more occupation. You know, after 56 years of Israeli rule over the West Bank and Gaza, the settlement of 750,000 settlers, the building of roads and infrastructure, the incorporation of the occupied territory, the West Bank in particular, into Israel proper, you can't talk about occupation, which is a temporary military situation. It's permanent. Israel's made it so that there is one state between the river and the sea. There's one governing authority. There's one law system. There's a couple. There's military law as well, but it's, the Israeli legal system is over the entire country. Physically, militarily, economically, there's only one state today that exists.
And the minute you cross over the King Hussein, the Allenby Bridge from Jordan, over the Jordan River into the Jordan Valley, you're in Israel. It is as Israeli as Haifa and Tel Aviv.
On the contrary, the Jordan Valley's been cleared of Palestinians. It's almost all Israelis, except for the little enclave of Jericho.
Okay, so half the
So the point I'm trying to make is, if you already have a state, but you cannot give citizenship to half the population, because they're not Jewish. It has to be a Jewish state. But you also can't allow that half the population to remain on their lands because you want their lands for the land of Israel. And apartheid is the only way out for a settler colonial country like Israel. To take the Palestinians that you can't get rid of, you try to get rid of as many as you can, making them refugees or killing them or whatever, like in Gaza, but in the end, they're staying. That population. So you have to confine them to Bantustans. It's the same thing as South Africa. Now, apartheid, I think, is not sustainable. People, the people that are being imprisoned can't accept that system. They're going to continue to resist, whether it's in terrorism, so-called, or armed resistance, armed struggle, or politically, like the ANC did. I mean, they had an armed wing, but they also had a very strong political wing. Same with the FLN in Algeria. So in other words, Israel, there's no way that Israel can normalize the situation. So what Israelis have to do is frame it as if we're the victims, we're the peaceful country, they're terrorists. You have to criminalize, and you can't open a discussion that at all legitimizes the Palestinians as a party in this. Because the minute you do that, you're calling into question your own legitimacy.
How do you see that conversation opening up? How do you see this being resolved? I mean, this is the big question. If the international community, of course, what's that? The United States, I can't conceive of the United States ever demanding that Israel either become a single democratic state or that the two-state solution become something more than just a vision and that there be a pathway there. But God forbid they should force it to happen. And, you know, the UK, Germany, the Western powers, I can't see them making this happen. What do you see to be the end of the tunnel in all this?
Well, the whole idea of two states, first of all, we have to dismiss. I mean, it's childish, and they know it. I mean, I can't believe Blinken and Biden don't know the two states. There's no two-state solution. I mean, you know, you're not going to dismantle these huge settlement cities or the infrastructure of highways or Israeli military or whatever. So that means then that, you know, I'm in favor of one democratic state. I'm a member of the one of the founders of the One Democratic State campaign. Now, it's like South Africa, I think. In South Africa as well, the whites were not going to be party to dismantling the apartheid system. Why would they? They were the beneficiaries of it all, economically, and they have South Africa that had 89% of the land, and the Bantustans, where the black African population was confined, the huge majority was 11% of the land. You know, why would they dismantle that? And their conception, their term for the end of apartheid was a bloodbath. That was what they all believed would happen at the end of apartheid. So the ANC didn't bother to talk to the white population. They did in a sense, and in a very important sense. Let me backtrack a little bit on that. And that is that in 1955, in the Freedom Charter, the ANC said, we are all South Africans. The end of apartheid is against the apartheid system. This isn't against white people. White people will stay in this country. They'll be equal citizens. This is going to be one. We're all South, you know, we heard Mandela say that 100 times. We're all South Africans. But still, that didn't convince the white South Africans, of course. There were some whites that were important in the ANC as activists, but the vast majority, you know, didn't want the system to collapse. So what the ANC had to do then was to bypass them. Said, all right, the hell with you guys. We're not going to waste our time trying to convince you. We're not going to, because you have an interest in this system continuing. And they went to the international community, not the governments that were also against them, like governments are against the Palestinians. They went to the people, to us. I mean, you and I, people of our age, were all engaged in the anti-apartheid struggle.
So pivots to Palestine.
So what I'm saying is, it doesn't matter what Israelis think. Israelis are not going to at all be a party to a peacemaking process in which the state of Israel and the apartheid system is dismantled. They're not going to do that. And why would they do that? So we have to bypass them, like in South Africa. And we don't have the governments on our side. It's very close to the South African case in terms of its structure and strategies. And we have to go. I think the Palestinian issue has reached the level of support internationally, if you look what's happening, that the anti-apartheid struggle had.
But so there's no Palestinian leadership.
Now we get to the big difference. The big difference is there was an ANC. And there used to be a PLO, and Arafat dismantled the PLO because he wanted to be the president of the Palestinian Authority, and Abu Mazen has continued that. So that's a huge issue for the Palestinians. And there are Palestinians. There is a movement to try to either revive the PLO or create something new, but that's true. There is no vehicle. That's a huge difference.
And there's no national liberation movement. Palestinian.
Well, there's no vehicle for that. I mean, there could be, but
there's lots of grassroots Palestinian resistance.
That's right. That's right.
But there's no organized
because you don't have
national liberation
because
movement.
You don't have a PLO. That's one thing. A second difference is, all right, there's three. The second difference is that even though South Africa imprisoned the African leadership, like Mandela was 28 years in prison, and killed some, and some were in exile, nevertheless, there was a black African leadership could exist in South Africa and around. So there was a leadership. Here you have a situation where every single potential Palestinian leader from the age of 12 is identified. And this is true back in 1948. Israel had what were called the village lists. They were killing, because people are saying, where's the Palestinian leadership? I'm saying they were killing every potential, not even actual, Palestinian leader back in 1948. So every single Mandela that exists today is either dead or in prison. They're not out in the street. That's the second. And the third difference, which is really important, is that the ANC always had an end game. One person, one vote. So when we were boycotting South Africa, or we were demanding the end of apartheid, and people would say, well, what's after apartheid? We would all say one person, one vote. And whites were a part of that. And that's what allowed the transition in the end. That's what allowed us to end apartheid, because we all knew why we were boycotting, what the plan was. And then the plan was executed. The ANC developed the constitution before the end of apartheid. The institutions were in place and so on.
But there's no end game.
The Palestinians have no end game. Not only no vehicle, not only no leadership, but they have no end game. You know, if you ask Abu Mazen, he'll say two states. You know, some people talk about one state. Even the one state idea that we're working on hasn't really caught on in a active political way. Most Palestinians are just trying to survive. They're just trying to deal, or they're protesting, or they're resisting, or whatever. And that's the fatal flaw. And it's very hard. I'm cutting them all to slack. This isn't criticism. Because they've been dispersed on purpose, because there's no PLO hub to hold all the fragments of the Palestinian community together, and they're not in contact with each other, and the Palestinians in Syria are in terrible shape, and they're not in touch with the Palestinians in Lebanon that are in terrible shape, and they're not in touch with the refugees in Jordan who aren't in touch with the West Bank, who aren't in touch with Russia, with Gaza, who aren't in touch with Israel, who aren't in touch with the diaspora. You have all these Palestinian communities in a centripetal way, you know, going off without a PLO to hold them together, a center. And each one has its own survival issues to deal with. So they have different agendas. And so it's very hard to get the Palestinian people without the leadership, without a program, without a PLO, together enough behind a political program that they could do what I think they could do what the ANC did. They have the international support, but what they're lacking is that organization and leadership and program that the ANC had. And that's a little bit what our group, the One Democratic State Campaign, is trying to do, at least to insert the beginnings of a political program and to help generate that discussion.
So let me ask you, Jeff Halper, to wrap this up. And thank you so much for your time. It's now been, 51 years since you arrived in Israel as a kind of a very altruistic and open-hearted and imaginative and hopeful American activist.
But politically active.
And politically active.
Right.
Where do your hopes and expectations lie now? Like, where are you now?
Right.
Where is your head now?
Right.
Are you... Do you despair of the whole situation?
No.
Or do you see a light at the end of the tunnel?
No. Yeah. First of all, they don't have the luxury of despair. I mean, how could I despair? I'm living the good life, and you know, the Palestinians, if anybody's going to despair, it's them. It's not me. But I don't believe in hope either, because hope is a kind of religious concept that you know, people that are losing hope that they might win. Corporations don't hope that they can run the world. They work at it, and they have strategies. So I believe in struggle. and struggle. And you have to understand, and here I'm taking a leaf out of Miles Horton, who was a very important fighter for civil rights and for labor rights in the American South in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And he always said, Miles Horton said, you know, if you take a really significant chunk of social justice as your mission, you know, like dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian issue, you know that you might not, like Martin Luther King said, you might not see the mountain, you know, by the end of your lifetime. You know, it's not like, that's where burnout comes in, where activists think, all right, I'm gonna come in and we're going to, in a year, this will be, and then they burn out. If you understand that you're in a struggle for the long haul, it's the long haul. That's his concept. And maybe you can get to the resolution, but at least you're chipping away and you know that you're being effective. You know you have a strategy, you know you have an organization that we don't have, but that's what we're trying to. And you know that you're chipping away at it. It might be the next generation or two that are going to fulfill it, but that's what sustains you. The fact that you're in a struggle and you're doing what has to be done. And so I think that's what prevents despair. And that's why you don't need hope. As long as you're being effective and strategic, you can win. I believe we can win.
And you also realize it's the only thing you could be doing. Maybe you can improve at the margins or come up with a slightly new tactic.
That's right.
But you're only doing what you can only do.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's the reformist idea, you know, the fact that, you know, I can give some humanitarian aid. If I came to Palestinian families and I said, you know, I'll give you a little bit of money so you can survive your demolition for 6 months or something, you know, that's nice to do, but it doesn't change things. If you want to change things, you have to be involved in political struggle. And I think that's what sustains me. And other activists. But if you're lacking that political understanding, you know, if you do look at it in kind of a liberal way, that's a problem with the liberals, or in a humanitarian way that I think isn't constructive, then you do get into despair because nothing changes. So it's not that we can always lose a political struggle, but at least you know if you're in the struggle and you're doing what has to be done from a really good analysis of how to attack the oppressors, then I think that sustains you because you're really engaged in meaningful political work.
Thank you, Jeff Halper.
Thank you, David Kettenberg.
Jeff Halper is a founding member of ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's also the author of a host of books, including An Israeli in Palestine, War Against the People, and Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine, Zionism, Settler Colonialism, and the Case for a One Democratic State. Learn more about Jeff Halper, ICAD, and listen to our conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's special edition of the GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in Palestine. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your fabulous instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.